Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy, and how you can make the most of your own life, right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is psychiatrist Peter R. Bragan, M.D. And like the man said, it's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour. My show will have callers and guests, but not tonight. Next week I'll have a guest, and you'll be able to call in with any of your questions touching on psychiatry, therapy, and indeed, life. But not tonight. Tonight I want to introduce you more to me. This is the opening show. It'll get archived. And I want people to have a starting point on what I believe. Now, I'm best known for my reform work. I'm best known for my books criticizing psychiatric drugs, electroshock, lobotomy, and for my reform work. But underneath that is a set of values that I hold that is far more important than my criticism. In fact, the criticism flows from the underlying values. Now, when I was a young man and an angry man in my late 30s and 40s, very young, very angry, I didn't understand that the outrage I felt toward lobotomy, electroshock, the drugging of mental patients in the mental hospitals, I didn't understand that underneath all of that was something I was almost embarrassed to admit about, and that's empathy. That's caring for other human beings. Why, I was fighting for truth and justice, but why was I? Why do we fight for truth and justice? If we fight out of pure rage and anger, then we're fighting out of our own personal helplessness. But if we fight out of caring and love, what we do will be good for others. It'll be good. It may not change the world. You may not win prizes. But if you operate from caring about others in a genuine way, and we'll talk more about that as I go along, then you're guaranteed, I think, to do more good than you will do harm. Now, this is an exciting day for me because this is a marvelous radio network, and I'm really, really happy to be on it. I've worked with Gary Null, the founder of the network, for decades now. I think that Gary and I got started back in the 70s when he was helping me promote a campaign that I was running, an international campaign that was successful in stopping most of psychosurgery or lobotomy. And Gary was one of those few people who was in the public eye to come out and support unequivocally what I was doing. And since then, I've been on Gary's show, various shows, innumerable times, and on many of his videos, especially about the drugging of our children. And I want to say thanks to Gary Null for your wonderful work and for having me on the Progressive Radio Network. This is a very professional group of professionals. My engineer is Katie Fitzgerald, and I want Katie, would you say hello so I know you're there and you're listening and I'm secure and safe?
Hello, Peter. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing good. I am so glad to be on your show and so glad to be working with such incredibly competent people.
We are very excited to have you.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to start by examining what is therapy. See, I'm going to start with the good stuff, and we'll get to some of what's not so good, to psychiatry, drugs, diagnoses, hospitals, involuntary treatment, and so on, the psychopharmaceutical complex. The stuff of my books, not all of them, but most of them, and the stuff of most of my scientific articles. But I want to start out with therapy. And that inevitably leads to the question of what is life? What is life about? Because therapy is about enhancing life. Now, obviously, wiser men than I, going back to, well, I guess all the way back to Socrates and probably earlier folks we'd never even heard of, and Moses and Jesus and many modern folks have tried to address what is life. It's tough, it's deep, it's something for all of us to think about. But what I want to say is that you can't do therapy without thinking about that, because the person who comes to you is coming with a troubled life. not with a troubled arm, not with a troubled leg, and believe me, not with a troubled brain. That's a myth. The person's coming to you with a troubled life. And if we try to make believe that therapy is not about enhancing life and helping people with their lives, then we end up with techniques and technologies. And when we try to separate these techniques and technologies from the values we hold about how to live a good life, we always end up doing harm. You can't treat a human being like a broken radio, TV, or computer without hurting that human being. And as I'll talk about later, that's precisely why we end up giving toxic drugs, even shocking people's brains, and still occasionally, even in the U.S., cutting them with lobotomies and newer forms of psychosurgery. It's because we've decided to treat people like cars, automobiles, like the truck that's probably making noise that you can hear outside my office, like computers. And we're not like that. We're the folks that make the computers. We're the folks that make the trucks and the automobiles. We have choice. We make decisions. And I believe that we're ultimately really spiritual beings. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. So any therapy that pretends to be a technology or a technique, whether it's a purely behavioral therapy, whether it's a biofeedback therapy, if it's devoid of the values of life, it reinforces a wrong attitude toward life. And if it harms your brain, like all drugs do, in shock, then it's a very bad treatment. It's the opposite of enhancing a life. Now, this is going to be a bit of a grand tour, ultimately, but what's going to hold it together and make it work and make it meaningful, I hope, to you, is to return over and over again to basic values. And that's what's going to happen on my show from week to week. Monday nights, 5 p.m., you'll be guaranteed an unfolding of basic values as applied to how you can live your life and how you can help other people, whether it's your clients or your family, your loved ones, or even the students you teach, certainly, but even if you're a medical doc doing medical work or a lawyer doing legal work, how you approach the relationship, which is the core of therapy, will depend a lot on the kind of help you give. Now, what is therapy? Is it about curing a disease? That can't be. People come to therapy because they're suffering in ways that are understandable in human terms. Commonly, people come to therapy because they've lost a loved one. There's been a death, or more commonly, a breakup in a marriage or a breakup in relationship. Nothing tears our minds asunder as deeply as tearing our hearts asunder. And if you make believe that's a mechanical problem to be given a drug for, you have cheated the person of understanding the suffering they're going through and finding ways out, which inevitably involve daring to love again. Nothing in psychiatry is about curing a disease. If it's Alzheimer's, it is a disease, and God forbid a psychiatrist should mess with it because they'll give toxic drugs. It needs to be treated by neurology and by alternative medicines, often offering more than what the psychiatric medicines will offer. And I'm thinking even in Alzheimer's, you just want to most carefully avoid, maybe even more in Alzheimer's than in, say, most of us with normal and ordinary brains, you want to avoid giving something that's going to be intoxicating and harmful to the individual. Now, the therapy is not about curing a disease. Now, it can be to some extent about overcoming lifestyles of failure. We all live repetitive patterns and thoughts and actions that get us into trouble, just as we also have repetitive thoughts and actions that can help us out a lot, reminding ourselves to be loving, reminding ourselves to only speak things that will enhance a relationship or enhance the work we're doing, learning to live by sound ethics and honest values, including honesty itself. These are patterns, too, that we can learn to operate on. But there are other patterns where we're dishonest, where we hide our feelings when our feelings need to be made known, or when we express our feelings when our feelings are destructive and don't need to be made known, or when we fail in our duties and responsibilities, fail to take into consideration the lives of the other folks that we're dealing with, and ultimately when we fail to be empathic. Those are destructive lifestyles, and we can learn about them, and we can learn to overcome them. That's in part what therapy is about. It's also, I believe, in part about learning new values. Now, that's anathema to the psychiatrists. I mean, psychiatrists, oh, they don't deal with values, they deal with diseases. But in fact, it's about values, because what sustains human beings is what we believe in, whether it's humanity or love or God, or being responsible, or doing our work, or taking care of our children, whether it's large values, encompassing values like love, or whether it's practical values like acting in a loving way to specific people. We live by values. And you can't remove values. They're a big part. And you should be prepared as a therapist or a helper, or if you go to a therapist or a helper. I've been talking a lot about, you know, therapy here, but let's talk about the person who's going to get the help. You need to be ready to hear about values and to examine your values as well as your lifestyle. Now, is having a good life and going into therapy and being a therapist, is it about learning about our childhood as we grow? I think it is, whether you're in therapy or not. I think that history repeats itself, and the histories of our childhood repeat themselves, and we want to look at the decisions we made growing up. I mean, you may have decided growing up that you would never be angry at a woman because you saw your father being angry at your mother all the time, and then that's generally a good principle. You don't want to just get angry, but maybe that'll make you unable to stand up for yourself in your marriage. You're a woman, you've seen the hitting going on, you may be afraid to ever get married. You may decide, I'm not going to marry a man, look at how they treat women. So the lessons we get in childhood are based on our childhood. They're based on the judgment of children, us, the child. And while they may have been life-saving at the time, for example, you learn to shut up in an abusive family and not give mom or dad an excuse for beating you. I mean, that's not a bad thing to learn as a child, but it won't do you good in adulthood to either lie about your childhood or say nothing about it, or to go on not being honest with people and not seeking people that you can trust to accept your honesty. So you got to undo some of the patterns as you grow up. So that's part of what it's about, too. So, you know, it's partly about overcoming lifestyles of failure, learning new values, and also about learning the mistaken decisions and viewpoints we came to as kids. But what's really going on in therapy is beyond all of that. What's really going on in therapy is the relationship between you and the therapist. It's just like in a marriage or a friendship. So these are life lessons. You can take everything I'm saying about therapy right now, and it's a life lesson about your relationship with your mother, your father, your son, your daughter, your students, your friends, your coworkers. Because you see, therapy is about enhancing life. So what we're talking about again and again is life. And the center of life and the center of therapy is human relationship. Human relationship, as commonly when people have been abused, when they've been disappointed, or just simply not gotten a great deal of love. We need a huge amount of love growing up, and we often don't get it. People will decide they're going to make it on their own. I don't need a relationship. I don't need other people. And therapists will too often take that view. Well, first you got to make yourself happy. First you got to know who you are. First you got to know this and that about yourself. Well, that's nonsense. Well, kernel of truth nonsense. Because the real truth is that we are made of each other from the start of life. You were nothing when you were born, but potential. And if your mother paid no attention to you, or your other caregivers paid no attention to you, you would literally die. You'd curl up and die. That's what happens. Unloved children do not thrive. And if you're brought up in a family that speaks good English, you'll speak good English. If they speak good Italian, you'll speak good Italian. If they speak poorly and understand poorly, you will at the beginning speak poorly and understand poorly. You will have to de-indoctrinate and relearn. We are so much made of how we are brought up. If you were brought up in a religious environment, you may suffer the bad consequences of that if it's an abusive religion or used abusively. If you were raised in a warm and loving religion, then it will help you to grow throughout your life. It's all about the relationships fostered in your religion, in your family, in your school, and above all, with the people nearest and dearest and closest to you as a child. You're literally made of them. If you were nursed, you're made of your mother's milk. Whether you were nursed or not, you're made of your mother and your father's feelings and thoughts and attitudes. So understanding childhood is very important, but we're not stuck with it. We can become aware. We can make more decisions as adults about what we really want to do. That we do want to be loved, that we do want to stand up for ourselves, that we do want to live honestly, that we do want to reach out for excitement, that we do want to just grab the world and give to it and take from it in ethical and caring ways. That's what I think a good therapy is about, because that's what a good life is about. That these things just simply cannot be separated from each other. Now, without taking a break, let me tell you here at about quarter after that you're listening to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, and I am Peter Breggin, and my name is spelled B-R-E-G-G-I-N. You can learn more about me than any human being would want to know. In fact, you'll never be able to get through it all on my website, breggin.com, but it's organized well. You can find stuff, good stuff, breggin.com. You can download tons of my articles and other folks' writing. You can learn about my books. Now, taking a moment here for me to think through what I'm trying to get across to you, I'm really telling you that a lot of life is about relationship and that ultimately it's about empathic relationship. So if you have a husband or a father or a mother who's cool and aloof and uncaring and objective about you, it's going to leave you with an uncertainty about yourself and what you deserve in life. And if you then have a teacher who is hostile, aloof, uncaring, and objective about you, that's going to just add to it. And if you go to a psychiatrist who's even maybe worse than your husband, your wife, your mother, your father, is even more aloof, more, quote, objective, more authoritarian, or a psychotherapist, a non-medical psychotherapist who's like that, it's going to do you more harm than good. More harm than good. So when you seek a therapist, seek one with the same bravery, I hope, that you will seek a dear friend. Be willing to make a judgment to see if you're going to get what you want. And if you're going to be a therapist, you have to welcome that human being into your office as one of God's treasures. Really, you're going to have to really treasure that human being. And what is empathy? Is empathy standing in somebody else's shoes? Well, I don't quite know what that means. Is empathy feeling suffering when the other person feels suffering? I don't think so. If you feel suffering, I call it induced suffering. If you feel induced suffering, you're not going to be able to be a therapist or even a surgeon or a policeman or anybody who comes to the aid of other human beings. Empathy does not mean that when the other person cries, you suffer. No, it means you love. You care. So let me take a big step here and say, well, what is love? It's closely connected to empathy. Love is joyful awareness. Love is joyful awareness. I'm going to say it again. Love is joyful awareness. It's not misery. It's not having to share. It's not having to suffer. It's not having to sacrifice. Love is joyful awareness. Now, if you are joyfully aware of another human being, it won't even feel like a sacrifice when you do something for them rather than for yourself, because you'll be doing it for yourself because you're joyfully aware. Love is the one thing that does away with self-interest, competition, vying for things. Because when you love the other person, you take joy in them. You have joy in their very existence. Like I look at my wife, Ginger, God bless her, who is, I hope, able to listen to this show. When you look in your loved one's eyes and you feel happy, that's love. And that's a feeling you can have toward children, toward friends, toward pets. I have it toward Lake Cayuga. I have it toward the gardens I've created around my home on the lake. My wife has it toward music in a way I can't even imagine. So joyful awareness is something that we have toward any aspect of life, including toward God. Now, when we're empathic, we are loving. Empathy is a form of love. I've never said it before. I'm exploring myself right now with you. Empathy is a form of love. Therefore, empathy is a joyful awareness. But it's a particular kind of joyful awareness in which we are aware of the deepest feelings, thoughts, and experiences that the other human being is willing to share with us. Now, of course, there are going to come times when somebody shares something with us that we can't stand and wish they hadn't said. They tell us about something terrible and abhorrent they've done. Well, that doesn't mean when you're empathic that you say, well, I'm really glad to hear you beat the living daylights out of your five-year-old child. No. No. Well, you said something authoritarian and mean and cruel. No. But it means that you are welcoming that human being to share their life, his or her life, with you, that you take great care to treat that person with great care. And you treat that utterance in a way that allows them to share it with you, even while you acknowledge that certainly they must feel terrible about what they did, and certainly you want to help them not do it again. So you see, therapy isn't neutral. Helping another human being isn't neutral. Being helped isn't neutral. It's about the values we have. So when you're helping another human being, when you're doing it, you are doing it from your heart in a welcoming way. You can do it as a secular person, but if you have a spiritual sense to yourself, which I believe we all do, actually, I think if we don't have a spiritual sense, we're depressed. So, and we can be depressed with a spiritual sense, but you're guaranteed being depressed if you don't have a spiritual sense, and anxious, by the way. You're going to be depressed, anxious, and just about everything else that's going to happen if you deny your spirituality. But if you're a spiritual person, then you may believe in God, and you may, when you greet another human being, friend, patient, client, you will greet, as the Quakers say, that of God in them. Or you may greet, as Martin Buber would say, in an I thou relationship. You see, love is about treasuring, caring, nurturing, and in doing whatever we can that the other person wishes us to do on their behalf. Now, in therapy, we limit ourselves in what we can do. We can't have sexual exchanges. We can't fall in love. And if we do, we don't talk about it or share it as the therapist. You go and get some help from some other therapist so that you don't step over those boundaries. We don't go outside and have dinner together. We don't party together. We don't go into business together. Now, that's because it's all of those things in the outside world that we all have trouble handling. Not just your patient, if you're the patient, not just you, but me, the client. me, the client, if I'm being the client, me, the therapist. I don't really see a lot of distinction other than the roles that we adopt. And in therapy, we adopt a role which says, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. That is, we stay in therapy. But then within the therapy, we don't do things. And that's what allows therapy to prosper. It's a little mini utopia in which one person seeks help from another, a little mini utopia in which one person seeks help from another, or a couple or a group seek help from another, or maybe even a team of others. With me, it's me and a couple, or me and a family. And in that context, there are grave limitations on activity, and because of that, we can all be brave enough to listen to, and to talk, to learn, to share, and to care. It's a little mini utopia in which people don't hurt each other, use each other, or use each other to fulfill each other's needs other than the needs that are specific to therapy. The therapist gets paid, the client gets helped. These restraints are key to the whole process of therapy. So let me take a moment now and kind of look. Let me tell you again that this is Dr. Peter Breggin, and we'll be taking a break in a couple of minutes. But right now I want to remind you that this is the Peter Breggin Hour, the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. And in this hour, we'll usually have callers. And in this hour, we'll usually have guests. But in this hour, we will always have caring relationships. We will always be basing what we think and say on values. And we will always be trying to be the best we can be in order to help others be the best that they can be. That's what it's all about. It's not neutral. It's not about giving psychiatric drugs. It's not about diagnosing people. If you think about what I've just been saying about therapy, where would diagnosis fit in? What would you say? Excuse me for a moment while I deeply, empathically try to understand you, while I give you a tag that will enable me to choose a drug or justify a drug or a hospital or shock treatment. It makes no sense at all. It's moving from seeing the human being to not seeing the human being. Diagnoses are not just cookie cutter things, as I usually describe them, they're actually blinders. We put on diagnoses so we won't see the person, so we can do shortcut, harmful things to the person. So I want to emphasize that if you're listening to another human being and you're caring about another human being and you're being empathic to another human being, you're going to learn their story. Now, you may learn that they get obsessed about things or they feel compulsive about things. You may learn they get depressed about things and anxious about things. But you're not going to be thinking, oh, that's an anxiety disorder. That's an OCD. That's clinical depression. You're not going to be thinking that way. You're too busy thinking about the human being. And that's how I want you thinking about yourself. Whether you're in therapy or you're just out there listening to what I'm saying and saying, my God in heaven, where did this man come from? What is this all about? I want you to think that your life is about knowing your story, not your diagnosis, and it's about writing your story, writing your autobiography, building up your life. It's not about looking at it through the wrong end of a telescope so it gets smaller and smaller and smaller into a diagnosis. It's about making it bigger, more full of life, more in charge, more responsible, more loving, more beautiful. You get the picture? I hope you get the picture. This is Dr. Peter Breggin, and we are going to break.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is Glenn Ford. Join me and co-host Nellie Bailey every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for Black Agenda Radio, an hour of news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. That's Black Agenda Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you a conscious college student? If you're interested in progressive news and politics, we want to hear from you. The Progressive Radio Network is looking for radio hosts to discuss college life and the issues dealing with being in a university. Send an email to karalee@garynoel.com, K-A-R-A-L-E-E @garynoel.com, or call 646-307-4482 and tell me your radio experience and any idea you could contribute to PRN.
I'm Carol Brier, host of Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m. Please join us as we connect people, ideas, important information, and discover solutions to some of the most urgent problems facing us. Every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m., Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network.
A shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists try for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello again. Hello again. I hope you like that music. It's Vangelis. You remember Chariots of Fire, that wonderful, wonderful movie? That's one of his pieces of work. And another day I'll tell you what it is. I love that music. And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. And there was an error I heard on the intermission. We're just getting adjusted to the fact that I am now the one who is on at 5 p.m. I certainly hope that's true, Katie, is it?
It is true.
Okay. So what is the name of the other show, and when will it be playing so people can find it?
Black Agenda Radio used to be on at 5 p.m. on Mondays, and now it's on 4 p.m. on Mondays.
Okay. Thank you for that correction.
Yep.
And, you know, I will take callers. I originally thought I wouldn't, but I've really presented to you the positive aspects I wanted to of my thinking for this moment. And if anybody wants to call in, they are welcome to do so. Katie, you want to give them the number again?
No problem. The number is 888-874-4888. And again, that is 888-874-4888.
Now I want to go into some of the specifics about why conventional establishment organized psychiatry is offering people the opposite of life-enhancing therapies. It is literally offering people life-destructive therapies. Remember that what makes for a good life is being able to take responsibility for yourself, being able to love, being able to work. By work, I don't mean necessarily earning money. Raising a family is work. Being an artist, even a starving artist, is work. Being creative is work. Being an elder in the community who loves grandchildren or volunteers to help other elders is work. Work is anything creative that we do that contributes not just to our own life. It's not just about us. You think it's just about yourself. My gosh, you are a very anxious and unhappy person. I guarantee it. So it's really about what we give to others. In fact, the whole notion of self-esteem and isolation is a silliness. Self-esteem is about achievements we have in giving to others, in doing things according to the rules, succeeding, yes, but succeeding in ways that are meaningful to others. Even if you're winning a race or playing football, that's meaningful to others, or it's probably a waste of your time and other people's time as well. So even self-esteem is not just about self. It's about what we earn in this world out there. Now, love is different than self-esteem. Love is unconditional. I will love my children, my wife, my friends, but I don't always approve or hold in esteem what they do. And I want to feel love for myself, at least God's love for me, but I do not always esteem my behavior. Love is unconditional. It's the rock bottom. It's the starting point. It's the starting point of all helping relationships. It's the starting point of all healthy living. Being joyful about existence. Now, does that make you pie-eyed? Does that make you, what are some of the expressions, you know, seeing life through pink glasses or whatever it is? Make you Pollyannish to be joyful about existence? No. To the contrary, it makes you really and painfully aware of how far short we all fall in being loving, and indeed how hateful, violent, and awful much of the human condition is. It does, to be loving is not to ignore life. And the lessons of people who talk about love, whether it's Martin Buber or whether it's other Jewish scholars or whether it's Jesus or whether it's the Dalai Lama or Mother Teresa, people who talk about love are always, in a real way, and talk about it as a joyful awareness of life and a giving to life and a nurturing of life, always aware of the dark side. And I am painfully aware of the dark side, to which I now continue to talk about. If you are going to diagnose people or accept a diagnosis, probably a huge portion of my as yet tiny listening audience. But the good news is you may be listening to this long from now as part of a big audience looking at the archives, listening to the archives. But if you're a member of this audience listening, you may have a diagnosis. The odds are probably more than 50% that you've been diagnosed at one point or another in your life. I don't have any figures on that, but that seems quite logical. And certainly if you listen to NIMH, National Institute of Mental Health, which is actually a federal agency on behalf of the drug companies, as is the FDA and often the Department of Education. If you listen to them, more than half of us are going to be depressed in our lifetime or anxious. It's like it adds up to we're just all going to be suffering from a mental illness. Don't believe them. Believe we're dealing with life. Believe life is in front of us, that life is painful, that you need improved principles always, we need to work harder always, we need to live better always. It's not about having a diagnosis. And it's certainly not about having a treatment. That is medication, shock treatment, and things like that. No. All psychiatric interventions impair mental function. All of them. It's really, really important for you to understand that. Any psychiatric drug impairs mental function. One of the things I've written about extensively in my most recent books, I'm not even going to mention my books tonight by name. They're on my website, Breggin.com, Breggin.com, and you're listening to Peter Breggin. Drugs spellbind us. I call it medication spellbinding. They impair our ability to judge their effects. Often they would disrupt us, make us angry, make us sad, or make us euphoric, and we rarely think that it's our psychiatric drug. We think it's something else going on in our lives, that our lives are better, our lives are worse, or we get irritated at a husband, irritated at a wife, irritated at children. But in fact, drugs can stir up agitation. All drugs can do this, virtually all drugs. Aggravation, irritation, hostility, and aggression in us. But because we're spellbound by the drug, we don't realize it. All drugs have a tendency, all psychoactive drugs, to make us think we're doing better than we are. And I don't just mean this about psychiatric drugs, all psychoactive drugs. If you've ever been among people smoking marijuana, and they're talking about, and you're not, and they're talking about how profound their insights are or how hysterical their jokes are. No, judgment impaired, not so, if you're looking at it with an unmedicated mind. And quite often people will say to me, well, I'm doing much better on psychiatric drugs, Dr. Breggin. How do you explain that? Well, so often they seem sad or anxious or inhibited, and they don't know it. Now, some people may feel they're doing better on psychiatric drugs. They may feel that psychiatric drugs are real good for them. And I say that's fine, but I want you to understand how they work. I want you to know how they work. And I don't want you to stop them quickly or without clinical supervision, because not only do you get spellbound about the effects and not know what's happening to you while you're taking the drug, the same thing happens during withdrawal from any and all psychiatric drugs. They all, during withdrawal, have adverse effects. Most psychiatrists don't agree with that. Most don't know that, but it's true. That's because any psychoactive substance, alcohol, nicotine, marijuana, LSD, Prozac, Paxil, all of the antidepressants, all the mood stabilizers, all the antipsychotics, they're not welcomed by the brain. The brain doesn't welcome then the drugs the way I want you to welcome your patients and clients, or the way as a patient or a client you want to feel welcomed, or how you should welcome your children and your wife as a husband, or your husband and your children as a wife. They don't say, ah, welcome aboard psychiatric drugs. I'm glad to see you. I'm empathic toward you. I want to know more about you. I love your influence. I really am glad to be with you. No, the brain says, get out of here, toxin. And in the case of every psychiatric drug, the brain not only experiences a toxic effect, it reacts against the toxic effect. For example, if you're taking an SSRI antidepressant that's supposed to increase the amount of serotonin in your brain in some way, which it does not, your brain immediately reacts against the effects of the drug, which is trying to increase the serotonin in your brain by doing everything it can to reduce the serotonin in your brain. It slows down the production, it speeds up the removal, and eventually it even gets insensitive to the serotonin in your brain. It's called downregulation or subsensitivity. Not good for your brain. So all psychiatric drugs, all psychoactive drugs produce a reaction. There's no way around it. The brain doesn't like intrusions. It's got something called a blood-brain barrier that consists of tissues and chemicals and cells that are doing everything they can in order to keep the drug from getting in, and then to keep the drug from having an effect. And if you're a pregnant mother, the drugs go through the placenta. Don't believe the psychiatrist who says, oh, don't come through too much, or They're going through the placenta. If they can get through the blood-brain barrier, they can get through the much more open placenta. And if you're a nursing mother, they can go through your milk. Do you know that babies born to mothers on psychiatric drugs, the babies go through withdrawal after they're born? Do you know that nursing infants who come off the breast will go through withdrawal from a psychiatric drug that the mother's been taking? So you got to be aware of all this. But don't just rush out and stop the drug. Because if you've been taking a drug for months or years, you're going to need some help probably in coming off. And you got to do it slowly. And the slowness is really paying a lot of attention to yourself. And you need an empathic guide. You need a psychiatrist who isn't going to say, oh, we'll take you off a half today. Then we'll take off another half tomorrow and that's the end of it. You know, we'll do it in a week or two. You don't want to do that if you've been on for months or years. You want the doctor to pay attention to your feelings. You want an empathic guide who's going to say, we'll take a little bit off and see how you feel. See how you feel. What are the odds in getting that from a psychiatrist? I'll let you do that. I'll let you make up something about that. Now, I see that a wonderful man is on the line, Doug Bauer. Doug, are you there?
Yes, sir, I'm here. Just checking in with you with your new program.
Doug, you're loud and clear.
All right, super. You got good connections then today.
Yes. Let me introduce people to you. The way this works, by the way, folks, you wonder, what's this magic all about? I'm being IM'd by wonderful Katie Fitzgerald, my engineer, my boss. Something like a wife, you know, they're really, really controlling your life and giving you good advice. And without them, everything would go downhill. That's how I feel anyway. But anyway, that's terrible. I don't know what Ginger's thinking right now as my wife. But Doug, Doug Bauer is a minister.
Right.
Doug Bauer has run for political office, unfortunately didn't win. We hoped
right.
for it, but I think it's, you know, you're going to win one of these days. Doug Bauer is a counselor and a therapist, and we've never met, but we like each other so much that Doug Bauer has joined the advisory council of my new center. So let me plug my new center for a second. It's a nonprofit. We just got nonprofit status in New York State. It's the Center for Empathic Therapy. Doug is on the advisory council, and I hope we'll be coming to our annual meeting in April. And my wife came in and blew me a kiss, so everything is okay. Wow.
Well, that's a pretty good deal.
That's really good. So you can find out more about Doug and his accomplishments by going to empathictherapy.org, and check out the advisory council, and Doug is on it. How are you, Doug? Have you been able to hear most of the show?
I was able to get started tuning in about half past. I had I do some work locally here with a football team. You were talking earlier in your program about doing essentially being involved in meaningful activities and consequently you called it work, but that work wasn't always in relationship to getting paid for something, and I see community involvement as one of those work things that I do in my life. So I just had gotten in. I deliberately came in a little bit earlier so that I could hear what you had going on today, since this is the first day you've done that at this program, as I recall.
Yeah, this is opening night. You're on opening night, Doug Bauer.
Yeah. And hopefully you continue. So I picked up here about 20 minutes of your program.
Any thoughts? Why don't you just add some thoughts to what I'm presenting here? And you think I'm presenting a good view of what I think and indeed what you think? Do you differ from what I'm saying?
Well, I think it's been really helpful for you as a psychiatrist to present the other side of dealing with medications in the treatment of mental illness. It's so routine and almost unquestioned by so many in the profession that I think it's real important to hear from somebody who actually has had medical psychiatric training the consequences of taking medications. I have no prescription powers whatsoever, but certainly have seen what happens with people when they take medications and the stupor that can occur, the false sense of security that can occur in relationship to medications, also the side effects that happen, like you give somebody something for depression, they might get anxious as side effects, and so they get medication for the anxiety, well then the side effects for that are something else that may actually aggravate the depression, so it becomes a vicious cycle. So I think it's really good to hear from you on that.
The drugs impact, much like lobotomy or shock treatment, all psychoactive substances, not just psychiatric substances, but any substance that has a psychoactive effect is having a disruptive effect on the biochemicals of the brain. They all impact most directly and quickly on what we would call spirituality, on the highest abilities in the human being. The first thing to go is going to be that fine-tuning of love and social awareness, because the reasons human beings have huge frontal lobes, you know, that fill up our heads, whereas our dogs and even chimps and gorillas have flat heads, we develop these huge frontal lobes because we were becoming these really intricate social animals who used language to relate to each other in these complex and subtle ways. And that's the beginning of the flowering, these front lobes. In fact, the front lobes developed completely before human beings made ships, made planes, made computers, made the internet, made the plow, probably even before we made fire. I don't know for sure. But the front lobes were fully developed, certainly before all the technologies and all the civilization that we have. So they were the seat of this ability for human relationship. And it's that higher center fine-tuning that lobotomy is about. It cuts into that to reduce caring, love, empathy, so that the individual is less of an individual and more docile and easier to handle. Shock treatment does the same. A blow on the head does the same.
Right.
People who are exposed to any trauma to the brain, including all drugs, they have less of that highest ability to be empathic and to be caring. Now, for some folks, that's a relief. They experience it as a relief. They seek it as a relief. But what I'm saying is there's just a lot more to offer human beings than a blunting relief or a distorting euphoria. There's the hope of a better life that you can have with the unmedicated mind and with better principles and sometimes with really good help. One other thought that I wanted to bring out in response to you, Doug, this is Dr. Peter Bregan, I'm a psychiatrist. We're talking to Doug Bauer, who is a minister and a counselor, a therapist. The other thing I wanted to say is I don't even use the concept mental illness, and I don't think you really probably hold to it in a strict sense, because these are what people suffer from are psychological, spiritual issues. They have conflicts. They have conflicted values. They have a lack of values. They have problems loving and being loved and being creative and daring to live by the principles they want to live by. And that's true of all folks. And if you're looking at somebody who has got what's called a schizophrenic disorder, i.e. they're having a terrible time in life and they're hearing things and seeing things because life is like a nightmare, you're looking at somebody who more than anyone else you might meet needs a relationship, needs trust, needs caring, needs encouragement, needs a little guidance in their values. And indeed, the last thing they're going to need is a reduction in brain power with psychiatric drugs. What do you think, Doug?
Well, yeah, I think medications and whatever mechanisms they do what they do in the brain tend to diminish the brain's own capability of producing serotonin or whatever it needs to make those gaps work. But there's another part of this that I think gets lost, and that is the loss of respecting my experiences. And that drives people into dark depression, dark discouragement, being overwhelmed, and that there's a loss of appreciation for my experiences and thus to be able to enjoy them. Well, then I guess you have to ask the question, how can you enjoy depression? Well, you have the depression because you're not happy about life circumstances. You mentioned spirituality, your personal interactions diminish. So all this kind of feeds in. Well, now I take medication to escape the depression, but it really doesn't work. It covers the ailment. It doesn't help a person get to those neat experiences of joy and celebration, where the ideals of spiritual experiences and personal experiences really ought to have that component of being a place to help people get to a place of celebration and enjoying life and appreciating things. When that's lost, everything gets stifled. And I think medication does help stifle that further. It doesn't liberate people. It puts a lid on things.
Yeah, I totally agree with you about that. And I think any psychoactive substance does that. Doesn't matter what you're doing. If you're doing it on a regular basis, you're doing it weekly or on some other regular basis, depending on the drug, it's going to have those stifling effects on your humanity. Now, it may give you some comfort. It may let you get through the day in your own mind. It may put you to sleep once in a while, though in the long run it will cause insomnia. But it won't give you what you need, which is that zest to really confront and live your life. When someone right. comes to me, Doug, and they're feeling horribly depressed and even suicidal, I literally welcome it. I welcome their feelings. I tell people after listening, I'm listening carefully. I'm listening with all the ability I have at the time. And then I explain that I get it. I get how you want to die. But let me tell you, you wouldn't want to die if you didn't have a frustrated image of a life that is so much better. The proportion that you hate yourself, you hate your life, you feel down and depressed, to that proportion, you have an energy to love life, to be creative. I tell people I'm more worried about somebody who comes in and doesn't have a lot of feeling than about somebody who comes in hating their life and wanting to die. And God, I don't want suicide. And I've been blessed by God, and I've never had a suicide in my practice. It can happen to any good therapist. It can happen to a good person in a marriage. They can have a suicide. It's not happened to me. But one of the reasons I think it hasn't happened, in addition to luck and blessings, one of the reasons it hasn't happened is I don't try to suppress feelings of depression. I don't get scared when I hear somebody's suicidal. I can look at them honestly and say, hey, been there. Let me tell you, that degree of negative feeling I had about myself and my life was a signal of what a real life I wanted to have. And you can have it too. If you can hate your life, you can love your life. You can have it too. Just don't kill yourself, because that'll end the trip. That'll end the opportunity. Right. And I guarantee you that as depressed as you are now, you can learn to be that full of life and love in the future. So I'm not afraid of feelings. And too often in psychiatry and counseling, we are terrified of feelings.
Right.
Doug, your thoughts on it? We have about 2 minutes. Give me a minute of thought, and then I will say goodbye.
Okay, well,
my opening show.
I basically have had the same experience as a counselor and therapist in the sense I've never had anybody in my practice, didn't have a particularly large practice, but either also in relationship to my churches that I served, who tried to kill themselves. And I have felt like the atmosphere of respect of that person tells me that they feel so badly about themselves that they want to end their lives, respecting that has contributed to their getting out of that.
Exactly, exactly. Well, let me tell you that you have been listening to Doug Bauer, who's from Georgia and who's a member of our organization, the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy. You can learn more about Doug on looking up the Advisory Council on empathictherapy.org. I want, on my first voyage here, to thank very much Katie, and especially to thank the whole network. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.